have second case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota Appellant versus Tyler Tillman, Vincent Rossi, and Jessica Wallace Appellees for the State of South Dakota. We have Mr. Timothy, and is it Bruno?
Barno, yes.
Barno, because I must have butchered it good last month. And for the State of South Dakota and for the Appellees, we have Mr. Matthew Kenny, an attorney from Spearfish, and Mr. Bradley Gorge, an attorney from Rapid City. And I understand, Mr. Kenny, you'll be presenting this morning, correct?
I will.
All right, very well. And you'll be arguing for all Appellees.
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Bruno, if I got it right this time, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. The issue in this case is whether the evidence seized from defendant's apartment was the fruit of illegal police activity. Because the probable cause for the warrant was derived entirely from evidence legally gathered by police before the detention occurred, the trial court erred by suppressing the evidence. The relevant facts of this case are as follows. On September 13, 2010, the Spearfish Police Department received a complaint of an odor of burnt marijuana coming from the defendant's apartment located at 740 University Avenue or University Street apartment number 4. Officers Little and Johnson were dispatched to investigate. The officers arrived at the defendant's apartment at 1:08 p.m. and confirmed that the odor of marijuana, burnt marijuana, was coming from inside their apartment. The officers knocked on the door, and defendant Rossi opened the door. The officers asked if they could come in, and defendant Rossi granted them permission to enter. Upon this consent, the officers entered the apartment and asked defendant Rossi if there's anyone else in the apartment, to which he responded his roommate, defendant Jessica Wallace, was also there. As the officers spoke with the two defendants, they noticed that when they entered the apartment, the odor of burnt marijuana became stronger. They also noticed that there was a towel rolled up at the foot of the door to keep the odor of burnt marijuana from escaping the apartment. They also observed marijuana in plain view, as well as spray, air fresheners, and rolling papers. The officers informed the defendants that it was illegal to use marijuana and asked to search the apartment. Defendant Wallace told the officers that they would need a search warrant if they were going to search the apartment. The officers then detained the defendants, handcuffed them, posted an officer at the door to secure the scene, and took defendants Wallace and Rossi to the police department. They arrived at the Spearfish Police Department at approximately 1:46 p.m., at which point Defendant Wallace was placed in the booking room, and Defendant Rossi was placed in an interview room. Officer Johnson immediately began preparing a search warrant affidavit and request for search warrant. At around 4:17 p.m., Tyler Tillman, the third defendant and occupant of the apartment, arrived at the apartment and was detained and brought to the police station. At 4:55, the officers faxed the warrant and the affidavit in support of the warrant to Magistrate Percy. At 5:35, the magistrate found probable cause to issue the search warrant and faxed it back to the officers. At 5:45, the police executed the warrant and found marijuana, psilocybin mushrooms, and prescription drugs, including hydrocodone and oxycodone. The defendants, Rossi and Wallace, were in police custody for approximately 3 hours and 49 minutes and Tillman for an hour and 18 minutes before the magistrate issued the warrant to search the apartment. The trial judge chose to suppress this evidence obtained from the search and the statements made by the defendants after the search because the court believed that the police had detained the defendants for too long. The trial court's suppression order in this case is an error for several reasons. First, because the evidence that he suppressed is not the fruit of any illegal police activity. Second, detaining the defendants was not unreasonable. And third, because the post-search statements were voluntarily made after the defendants were given their Miranda warnings.
Do you see a distinction between the property seized at the apartment and any statements made at the police station while in detention or whatever you want to call it?
No, because after the search warrant had issued, the police went and searched the apartment and seized the evidence. At that point, the search warrant also authorized the police to obtain UAs from the defendants, urine samples so they could get UAs. So I'd almost argue that the detention should be divided into two parts, what actually happened when they detained them at the apartment, and then the question that took place post-search after the search warrant, based on evidence seized pursuant to the search warrant, actually, I would argue, is based on the search warrant more so than the initial detention, Your Honor. So I don't think there's any distinction that the statements made were not the product of illegal police activity either, because they were, in essence, based upon the warrant.
Were any of the statements used as a basis for obtaining the search warrant?
No, they were not, Your Honor. If you look at the search warrant affidavit, all the evidence in the search warrant affidavit that the officers used to get probable cause and the magistrate also found there's probable cause to issue the warrant on, was all evidence obtained when the officers initially entered the apartment based on the consent they received from Defendant Rossi. So there was no illegal police activity. They observed the marijuana and the drug paraphernalia laying around the apartment. They sent the affidavit for a search warrant up to Magistrate Percy. She found that that legally obtained evidence amounted to probable cause to issue the warrant. And then the trial court also found that that evidence amounted to probable cause to issue the search warrant, Your Honor.
And did the trial court also find that, at least with respect to all of them, that there was probable cause to arrest all of them?
The trial court specifically found there was probable cause after the officers entered the apartment and made their observations to arrest Rossi and Wallace. I argue, although the trial court didn't specifically find that, those same facts supply probable cause to arrest Tillman as well, because he was a resident at the apartment with knowledge of what's of the drug activities or activities taking place.
The trial court didn't find that.
But the trial court did not specifically find that.
Because how would the policeman know that Tillman had knowledge of drugs in the apartment if he wasn't there?
Well, he was a resident of the apartment, Your Honor, and he lived there. He was, at the time, Jessica Wallace's boyfriend, and they shared a room, and they're, I would argue that he had knowledge of the activities taking place in that apartment. At least they're imputed to him based on the observations that the officers made when they were inside the apartment.
The officers were looking at or smelling burnt marijuana.
From outside the apartment, yes.
So they were, obviously this is a case where they were smoking marijuana.
Yes.
In the apartment.
At the outset, yes, Your Honor.
And Tillman, there's nothing to suggest Tillman was there when they were smoking marijuana.
No, he was not. He was not there when they were smoking marijuana. He arrived later, Your Honor.
Was there a UA taken from Mr. Tillman?
There was. There were UAs taken from Defendant Tillman and Defendant Rossi. Defendant Wallace, there was no UA obtained from her because at the time when the officers went to obtain a urine sample, there was no female officer present, so they were unable to obtain one.
Was the UA from Tillman incriminatory?
Yes, it contained THC.
It did.
And that was obtained after the search warrant was executed?
After the search warrant was executed, yes, Your Honor. The interviews took place promptly after the search warrant was executed at 5:45. Special Agent Artis returned to the station at 6:26 and began interviewing Vincent Rossi. And that's when he got the urine sample from Defendant Rossi. And Rossi spoke he was given Miranda. He understood his rights, and he waived his rights, and he talked with Special Agent Artis and admitted that the psilocybin mushrooms found in the living room and the freezer belonged to him. Then, when Special Agent Artis was finished interviewing Rossi at approximately 8 o'clock, he helped with an amendment to the search warrant, and then he went and interviewed Defendant Tyler Tillman at approximately 8:02 p.m., at which point he gave him his Miranda rights. And Tyler Tillman actually started reciting the Miranda rights back to Special Agent Artis. He was so familiar with them. And then he chose to speak with him. He denied that the drugs actually belonged to him. And he said that the mushrooms found in the bedroom belonged to his girlfriend, Defendant Wallace. He also gave a UA, as I said, at that point. And at 9:30, he spoke with Special Agent Artis till 9:30. And at that point, when Special Agent Artis finished interviewing Tillman, he went and interviewed Wallace, gave her Miranda rights, and she chose to invoke those rights and not speak to him, and the defendants were promptly released after that, Your Honor. Now, it's well settled that suppression is not justified unless the challenged evidence is in some sense the product of illegal governmental activity. If you look at the Segura case, The agents, there was an illegal entry into the defendant's apartment. The agent seized the apartment, arrested the defendants, and 19 hours later, a search warrant issued based on evidence that was obtained prior to the legal entry. The Supreme Court found that evidence was admissible. It ruled that law enforcement's initial illegal entry into the defendant's apartment was irrelevant when probable cause supporting the warrant was derived from legally obtained evidence that predated the entry. So too in this case, the legality or reasonableness of detaining the defendants is really irrelevant when the probable cause to search their apartment was derived from legally obtained evidence that predated the detention. As we spoke about, the affidavit was based on probable cause that was obtained from the entry into the apartment with the consent of Defendant Rossi. Furthermore, the trial court found that the warrant was valid and based on probable cause, and they did not find any bad faith on the part of police. They did not find the police purposefully delayed obtaining the warrant. And basically, they just found there was probable cause to detain the defendants as well.
Why did it take so long to get that warrant?
Well, when you look at the actual time frame, it didn't actually take that long to get the warrant. They arrived at the station at 1:46, and they had to place Defendant Wallace and Defendant Rossi into interview rooms. And then Officer Johnson, who was a new officer, it's the first time they'd written a search warrant, began working on the affidavit. In the middle of the affidavit, Tyler Tillman arrived at the scene and was detained, so we had to add him to the affidavit. He also had several other officers review it to make sure that it was complete and contained all the information that he needed to get the warrant issued. So when you actually look at the time that it took, it didn't take that long to get the warrant. There's definitely no bad faith on the part of police. At worst, it took him a little while longer than maybe it would an experienced officer to get the warrant, but there was no undue delay, no purposeful delay, Your Honor. Now, I'd also like to talk about the detention a little bit. In this case, there was probable cause to arrest the defendants when they arrived at the apartment. Furthermore, once the search warrant was issued, they needed to detain the defendants to question them about the evidence that the officers now had in hand, as well as get urine samples from the defendants. Now, obviously the officers could have arrested the defendants from the outset, or they could have arrested them after the search warrant issued and they found the drugs in the apartment. However, they didn't. They merely detained them, and it follows that the availability of a more restrictive alternative, which in this case would have been arrest, necessarily implies the reasonableness of a less restrictive alternative, which in this case was detention.
Well, but you can't, I mean, as a matter of fact, you can't really argue that there was a mere detention as opposed to arrest here. I mean, they were handcuffed, put in the car, under any test that the courts ever use for arrest. These people were arrested.
Well,
they weren't free to leave.
No, they're not free to leave. And whether a detention is formally called an arrest or not is really irrelevant, Your Honor. The test that's applied is the general rule under the Fourth Amendment that seizures of the person having the characteristics of a custodial arrest, whether or not it's actually called an arrest, must be based on probable cause. So if we just apply, now there are some limited exceptions for Terry and a few other cases, but if we just apply the general rule in this case, the detention is based on probable cause, we don't need to go further than that, Your Honor. And if the court's looking for a measuring stick for just this detention, I would argue that we should look at the law as it's applied to an arrest. If the court feels that it rose to the level of an arrest, then we should look at it under the rule that if someone's arrested based on probable cause without a warrant, they're held for 48 hours, they have the right to a probable cause determination before 48 hours is up. I think that if you kind of use that as a measuring stick to decide when a probable cause determination must be made, then I argue that that's a measuring stick the court should use. And the detention in this case was nowhere near that, Your Honor.
But aren't we supposed to use, like the trial court did, use the balancing test in MacArthur, where we balance the rights of citizens against the needs of the law enforcement officers? What possible need was there to detain these three people if all the officers had to do was post somebody at the door and say, you can't come back in the apartment until we execute the search warrant.
Well, Your Honor, first, in MacArthur, there was not probable cause to arrest the defendant. There was probable cause to get a search warrant, and they merely secured the scene and didn't let him reenter the apartment, or his trailer, actually, in that case, it was a trailer. In this case, we had probable cause to seize the defendants from the outset. And I think that's a very important distinction that the court has to make. Probable cause for arrest authorizes a much different level of detention than the reasonable, than probable cause to just get a search warrant, having reasonable suspicion towards the defendant. Therefore, since this is based on probable cause, we have to look at the balance between the police officer's needs and the defendant's rights a little bit differently, Your Honor, especially since under the Fourth Amendment test, it doesn't violate the Fourth Amendment because it was a seizure based on probable cause. As I stated before, the statements the defendants made were voluntary. They were made after the search warrant was issued. The defendants, Rossi and Tillman, read their rights, and they voluntarily waived those rights. They were familiar with them. And they chose to speak with Special Agent Artis at length. Actually, that is another reason why it took a little while longer for them to be released in the end, is because they were both, those two defendants talked to Special Agent Artis for almost an hour and a half apiece. When Defendant Wallace was given her rights, she refused to speak with officers, and the defendants were released at approximately 10 o'clock p.m. There's nothing in the record to show that the defendants didn't voluntarily waive those rights, that they didn't understand them, so I argue that those statements made after being given giving Miranda rights are admissible as well. In the case at hand, probable cause to search the apartment did not issue due to illegal police conduct, and thus suppression of legally obtained evidence was not the proper remedy. As this court reversed the trial court's ruling suppressing the evidence and the defendant's statements. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kinney, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the justices of the court, counsel. Thank you. But the cornerstone of the Fourth Amendment is reus medius. And seizures apply, of course, under the Fourth Amendment. And what is reasonable as a seizure? I think that is the issue here today. The proper case that the court would analyze this is Illinois v. MacArthur. And I don't believe there's any direct case on point in South Dakota case law. It's perhaps a case where a holding may be a first impression for this court. But the United States Supreme Court cases have addressed the issue of reasonableness as a seizure. The state seems to want the court to determine that if there was probable cause, then that's really the only thing that really matters here, and the actions of the officers in the seizure is something that is not to be subject to the exclusionary rule. I would submit to the court that the proper remedy in this case is the exclusionary rule. It's not fruit of the poisonous tree. It's not the Wong Sung case. It is Herring versus the United States, or in this case, State v. Bull, as we used it, or in this jurisdiction, State v. Bull, B-O-L-L. The measures here involved over an 8.5-hour detention in Spearfish on a Monday, September 13th, 2010, when Judge Percy was in her chambers in Deadwood. As we know, there's no courthouse in Spearfish. The officers have to call up to Deadwood to get their warrants. In 2010, we have modern technology. We were able to fax, email. We are able to telephonic warrant requests. We're able to get to our judges fairly quickly, especially on a Monday afternoon. If this case occurred perhaps at 11 p.m. at night, or maybe on a weekend, if it occurred maybe in Camp Crook, South Dakota, far away from a courthouse or a magistrate judge, there may be circumstances that would allow a delay, maybe this time period. I would submit to the court that there was an unreasonable delay, as the trial court found, on behalf of law enforcement, Spearfish Police Department on that day.
How does that taint back to the evidence seized in the apartment, which was in plain view?
It doesn't. That's why the Wong Sung case doesn't apply, Your Honor. So The exclusionary rule is what the trial court found here to be the proper remedy to deter police conduct that was lacking in diligence and lacking of reasonableness in its duration for its
Maybe season. I misread the record. I thought he suppressed everything.
He did.
Okay. What was the basis for the suppression of the evidence from the apartment?
The basis of the evidence for the suppression of the apartment, I think, would be under the exclusionary rule. I guess he applied that. But I would agree that perhaps if there is evidence that was found, we're talking burnt marijuana, rolling papers, I think that's it. That's what they saw when they got consent to come in. They then seized the defendants, took them down to the station, guarded the place, and then we have evidence found after the search warrant was executed. So your question, Chief Justice, is what should we do? Should we separate these two different things? And I think the exclusionary rule can apply to both, because it was that evidence that led to the search warrant. Now, they had that evidence there, and they could have arrested these two defendants, at least, on scene. I believe they had probable cause. I think Justice Sinner is correct in pointing out that this is, for all intents and purposes, an arrest, but the officers did not want to classify as that. They didn't tell the defendants they were under arrest. They said they were being detained for investigatory purposes and for purposes of officer safety and avoiding destruction of evidence.
But by the same token, what the officers told the defendant, defendants, is really irrelevant. I mean, they were either under arrest or they weren't. It doesn't matter what the officers stated.
For purposes of determining whether they're under arrest, I agree. But to the defendant, it's different. If you're not told you're under arrest, and you're down at a police station, and you're just being held in a secured cell, deprived of all your liberty, I think it's a lot different, because when you're told you're under arrest, and even though the average defendant may not know that, as we know in State v. Larson, we have judicial process that begins. Review begins within a 48-hour period of probable cause. Bail can be set. Rights are there for that defendant.
All right. They were advised of their Miranda rights, though, were they not?
Later in the evening, they were.
Well, before they made the statements?
Before they made the statements, they were. As to the statements, they were made aware of Miranda rights, but they were never told they were under arrest in the entire 8.5 hours.
Well, normally that becomes an issue on whether or not they have to give Miranda rights, but in this case it isn't an issue because they were.
They were given their rights, yes. As to the statements, yes.
Okay.
Yes, but my point I made to Justice Sinner is that when a defendant is kind of in limbo, he or she is not under arrest, according to the officers. They're sitting all afternoon. They know they're being detained, but yet they're not told they're under arrest. I think the officers intended that to be that way. And there may be, I think the trial court found that there were purposes for that.
Even if we assume that, I guess I want to go back to the exclusion. Normally, how is the remedy, the exclusion of evidence that was obtained pursuant to a warrant based on separate evidence, how is that the appropriate remedy if you are correct?
Okay. The application of the exclusionary rule is exactly what the four-part test of Illinois v. MacArthur applies. And this case is decided about 16, 17 years later than the Segura case that the state relies on. There is a four-part test: whether there's probable cause, whether the officers had a legitimate concern in the evidence being perhaps destroyed or tampered with if they didn't secure the premises, whether the law enforcement balanced the privacy rights of the individual versus the law enforcement needs, and finally, the duration of the seizure based on whether there was a diligence and whether there were other factors involved. So the trial court applied that test, and basically, Your Honor, what the trial court found was that when the officers took these people down to the station at 1:46 p.m. and basically took 2 or 3 hours to fill out a search warrant that I would submit is mostly boilerplate. If you look at the search warrant, there's less than a page total of actual facts. And we also note that Defendant Tillman is taken into custody between this time. And they don't submit the search warrant affidavit request until after they get Tillman. Now, the record supports that Tillman was a person, I don't want to say a person of interest, but someone that Agent Artis had knowledge of from another drug investigation. Now, the record doesn't support that the officers explicitly waited until they got Tillman into custody before they decided to submit the search warrant and then make the search eventually and then ask questions in the evening. But other than the record is only showing that Mr. Tillman is someone that the police department had knowledge of. And I would submit that this is what the trial court kind of perhaps had in mind when we deter police conduct, that tries to delay things until perhaps some facts can come up that would make it easier for law officers to do their jobs. So,
I mean, all the facts that they needed to search that apartment, they had in the first 10 minutes, it seems. So how does the detention, how did the detention aid the officers in any way in getting any more? I mean, I'm having difficulty understanding why we're saying the detention caused a flaw in the search.
Okay. Well, I'm puzzled too. When I first looked at this case, I don't understand why the officers just arrested them. And if they felt that they had authority, search incident to arrest, to search the rest of the house, why didn't they question the defendants more? They felt, the officers felt, that because Jessica Wallace requested a search warrant, that they would comply with that. And so they, as a matter of policy of the Spearfish Police Department, take these individuals down to the station and detain them. They secure the premises, and then they sit on the case for 3 hours. Okay. And then they get Mr. Tillman in custody. Now, I don't know why they had probable cause even to detain him, as was asked earlier, but somehow they felt that because he lived there, they could take him in. They then decide to fax up the search warrant to Judge Percy somewhere around the 5 o'clock or 4 o'clock hour. And then Judge Percy then gives the search warrant at 5:45. They start searching. They then do the interviews after they procure the illegal substances in the apartment while Wallace, Tillman, and Rossi are all down at the station. It's only then they begin the interviews. And, of course, they do read Miranda. Rossi's interviewed first, Tillman second. And then they let him go, never telling him they're under arrest, and indict him 2.5 months later. This is what the trial court, I think, found to be procedurally flawed. And as to why those officers ever decided that they needed to get a search warrant when they had consent to enter an apartment and in plain view see and smell marijuana and rolling papers. I don't understand why they did that. And I think that's what the court found to be, in this case, something that the exclusionary rule would apply to under Illinois v. MacArthur. I think that case needs a lot of analysis because it would appear, I think, in looking at the record, that there were purposes.
So you're faulting the police for getting a warrant?
No, the fault in the police is not diligently seeking the warrant. The seizure is unreasonable in terms of its duration, the failure to balance the needs of privacy versus what the law enforcement officers really needed. It's not that if they would have got a warrant perhaps in the town of Spearfish, where the apartment was perhaps no more than 5 minutes away from the station, they got the warrant perhaps in an hour, maybe 2 hours. If you can stop to get a cup of coffee or something or whatever, waiting for the warrant to come back, I think the court would have found that to be reasonable.
You said something earlier that I'd like you to expand on. You said this is not a fruit of the poisonous tree case. This is a state versus bowl case.
Yes.
And could you expand on that? Because I'm not sure I follow that.
Okay. Because the evidence that was found pursuant to the search warrant came from a valid probable cause. Well, came from evidence that was found by valid probable cause earlier in the day, at the 1 o'clock hour, the small amount of marijuana. The obtaining of that evidence is not a but-for cause of an illegal search. Okay. And the Wong Sung case applies to evidence that was found from an earlier illegal activity or taint. The exclusionary rule applies to unreasonable searches and seizures that, under Illinois v. MacArthur, don't balance out the rights of law enforcement versus private interests, they take the duration.
MacArthur abrogates the further poisonous tree rule.
It applies instead of it, I would say. Yes.
It's hard to tell from the facts of that case whether the court really intended to do that, because in that case they upheld the search because all they did was detain this gentleman in MacArthur. They didn't imprison him. Can you quote me some language in there that where the court's saying fruit of the poisonous tree isn't going to apply, that this now we're just going to simply exclude the evidence if we think rights were violated?
The case that I would ask the court to consider in analyzing fruit of the poisonous tree versus exclusionary rule is a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals case called U.S. versus Song Ja Cha. And that's...
I see it's in there. You quoted it. You have it in your brief.
So you don't have to spell it.
Yeah. Yes, and in that case, Justice Konecamp, the court specifically stated that this was a 26-and-a-half-hour detention in Guam. It states, it is clear that the evidence cannot be excluded as fruit of an unreasonable seizure because the evidence was not the product of the illegality and because the warrant provided an independent source for the information. And he goes on, the Ninth Circuit goes on to say, here the evidence was not the product of the unconstitutional action because the unconstitutional seizure was not the but-for cause of the discovery of the evidence. I think that prompted your question. And then it cites some courts, or cites some other supporting cases. But they state that the analysis does not end. Although not excludable as fruit of the poisonous tree, the evidence must be suppressed as a direct result of the constitutional violation. And so,
all right, well, how is this a direct result of the constitutional violation? How is the evidence that was obtained a direct result of the constitutional violation?
We may be looking at, well, if the evidence came from something that was legitimately initially determined or found, why should we suppress any of it, or why should, as Justice Gilbertson states, why should we just suppress the latter part that was found? The answer to your question is this. When the seizure occurred at the time, the seizure went to a point which the trial court found to be per se unreasonable, well, not per se unreasonable, unreasonable given the circumstances, with all the facts taken into effect. And while that seizure occurred, that search warrant process was in effect. That search warrant process should have, in its in the officer's investigation, in their attempt to try to gain more evidence, interview people, they should have followed the Fourth Amendment in terms of what is an unreasonable detention. I would submit that because they didn't tell the people they were under arrest, they put them in limbo here for many hours, and they decided that we're just going to kind of go about our own pace is kind of the way I see it. They could have acted a lot quicker. And I think the trial court found that to be something that was unreasonable when they could have acted differently. And that's where the exclusionary rule applies as a remedy. Now, the state would argue that that's not the right remedy to apply, but we would argue the trial court made the correct decision. Deterring police conduct when I think if it's a policy to detain people and not tell them they're under arrest and let them sit at a station, what would be the limit under this analysis?
Well, wouldn't it be 48 hours?
Well, no, because they're not under arrest, according to the police. Who would determine that?
Wow.
If I'm an officer and I have a guy, if I take a guy that comes in from Minnesota and he's got drugs in the car, and I say, you know, I'm going to investigate you. And of course, it's going to be different. And an automobile's lesser standard than, but let's say he goes into an apartment. And we detain that person, and we hold him. The question becomes, how long is enough? Can we hold him for days? And then decide, well, we're going to arrest you now 2 days later or a day and a half later. And then your 48 hours starts. We'll take you up to the station, get you booked, call the judge for a bond, that kind of thing. So if you decide in this case that perhaps this was reasonable, I think this court is setting a precedent for a delay such as this and having people under arrest for 8.5 hours. And then, if you think about it, 2.5 months later, they're finally indicted, and to which the arrest finally comes upon the warrant of arrest following the grand jury proceeding. So that time isn't affecting the person's liberty, of course. It's the 8.5 hours they were there.
Wouldn't your argument carry more weight if they'd walked in and seized him on the spot before they'd seen anything in plain view?
Well, it would. I mean, that's just not part of the record, though. They knocked. Right. Rossi let him in with consent, and they saw those things there.
And you're not challenging the search warrant?
We are. The search warrant itself, we are not challenging.
The probable cause finding by the magistrate and the circuit court's affirmance of that finding.
The only thing I mentioned about the search warrant, although the trial court did not find it to be very applicable, is that the search warrant was amended later in the evening, not under oath, in a way that the officer did not tell the magistrate that the search was already conducted. We just needed to amend it to include things we already found there. Cell phones, prescription drugs.
Well, of course, there's no notice of review, so you're basically not challenging the court's ruling on that.
We are not. I think the judge found probable cause based on the information she had been provided to her. I think a lot of things could have been done differently here.
Do you challenge the fact that the circuit court found there was probable cause to arrest your client and Ms. Wallace?
No. But for the officers, they didn't arrest him. They detained him.
But you're not challenging that there was, they could have arrested him.
Absolutely not.
No.
They could have arrested him, and I don't think we'd be here. I think it would be a totally different situation. So with that, Your Honors, I appreciate the opportunity. It's been my privilege to argue this case, and I would ask the court find that the trial court, in applying Illinois v. MacArthur and factually finding that the police acted unreasonably here. And I don't see the state really offering any facts to dispute that. And although it's a de novo review on constitutional issues, I think the court should apply the clearly erroneous standard in terms of the findings of fact that Judge Johnson found here, how the police acted. And I've really never determined that to be something at issue in reviewing the Attorney General's brief, because they kind of tip the scales in an attempt to say that the officers need to do these things, but they never weighed the privacy issues, and the trial court did. And with that, I'd ask the court to affirm. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kenny.
Thank you. Okay.
Mr. Genoa, you have 10 minutes, sir.
So could you address the Song Jia Cha holding?
That's a 26.5 hour seizure that we're talking about there of a residence, and there's a lot of strange facts in that case. I mean, they detained the guy down at the station. They wouldn't let him get his diabetes medicine, things like that. I mean, it's just a totally different set of facts than what we have here, Your Honor, that I don't even think that case is applicable at all. But when you look at the but-for test that's applied to police misconduct, that's like the threshold to get into the exclusionary rule period. When you apply it in this case, there's no evidence that would have been, even if you look at this in the light most favorable to the defendant and say, all right, let's say the detention was illegal. Well, there's no evidence obtained from the detention. None.
Well, there's the statements. There's the statements that are obtained.
The statements, but those are obtained after the search warrants issued, authorizing the officers to get urine samples from those defendants, and they were Mirandized before they made those statements, Your Honor. And the defense is citing to the Bull case. Well, in that case, there was police illegality, several different illegal police entries onto the property, and the search warrant was based on, for the most part, on that evidence that was illegally obtained. And the rule passed by this court was that even if you were able to redact that illegally obtained evidence from the search warrant, and there was still enough evidence to find that there was probable cause to issue the warrant, then the evidence seized pursuant to that warrant still would have been admissible, Your Honor. Furthermore, as I stated, the exclusionary rule is in place to curb police misconduct. There's no police misconduct in this case. It's better to do things right before you do them fast. And Officer Johnson, this was his first search warrant, he wanted to do it right. Maybe took a little bit more time than an experienced officer would, but the trial court even said there's no police misconduct, no illegality. They didn't find any bad faith on the part of the police as far as the warrant goes. They just felt the defendants were detained too long. And they focused a lot on the fact they weren't formally arrested, but when you apply the Fourth Amendment rule that seizure, it's not relevant whether or not they're formally arrested, it's whether or not their seizure is based on probable cause, it shows that this whole detention argument is just a red herring. Furthermore, these defendants are complaining about being detained instead of arrested. And they're complaining that they weren't booked, that they weren't forced to strip off their clothes and get into jail jumpsuits, and probably spend the night in jail. I mean, if they're arrested, they're probably going to spend the night in jail because the officers are going to do the same thing that they were going to do here, which is question them, get urine samples from them, and everything else. It just doesn't make any sense to complain that you're detained, you're subjected to a less restrictive restraint than the officers are actually authorized to impose.
But in fairness, that's not their complaint. Their complaint is that they could have just been told, you know, take off until we get done searching your apartment. You can't come back in, as opposed to being detained for 8 or 5 hours.
There's probable cause to arrest them at that point, which is different from the MacArthur test. When you look at MacArthur, that limited detention that was imposed on was to secure the premises. There was not probable cause to arrest MacArthur at that point. And furthermore, when you look at the MacArthur test and you actually look at the reasoning behind it, the third part is whether the police made reasonable efforts to reconcile their law enforcement needs with the demands of personal privacy. Well, the police didn't interfere with their privacy interests in the apartment. A seizure affects possessory interests, a search affects privacy interests. So I'd argue that section of the test was misapplied. The police didn't illegally enter the apartment after they had seized it. They posted somebody outside the door, and they left it alone. And plus, at that point, the defendants are detained based on probable cause. And they didn't keep the apartment seized for any longer than they needed to execute the warrant and seize the evidence. Excuse me. Furthermore, the amendment to the search warrant is really irrelevant in this case. As you said, there's no notice of review filed on that, and the trial court found that if you look at the record, that there's no need to amend the warrant. They were authorized to search for all the stuff they found under the original warrant. So to apply the exclusionary rule in this case, where there's no illegal police conduct, there's no bad faith on behalf of the police, would be an extension of the exclusionary rule that goes beyond anything that is supported by any cases that have come down that I was able to find, and it just goes against the rule that if there's no police misconduct, then the exclusionary rule simply isn't applicable. So I would ask that this court overturn the trial court's ruling suppressing the evidence and the defendant's statements. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.